immediately met her. Elizabeth, as she affectionately embraced her, whilst tears filled the eyes of both, lost not a moment in asking whether anything had been heard of the fugitives. "Not yet," replied Jane, "but now that my dear uncle is come, I hope everything will be well. Oh, Lizzie, our sister abducted and repeatedly dishonoured, even as we stand here helpless. Is my father in town?" "Yes, he went on Tuesday, as I wrote you word."
"And have you heard from him often?"
"We have heard only twice. He wrote me a few lines on Wednesday to say that he had arrived in safety, and to give me his directions, which I particularly begged him to do. He merely added that he should not write again till he had something of importance to mention." "And my mother, how is she? How are you all?" "Mother is tolerably well, I trust, though she vomits often and quite copiously, as you no doubt expected. She is upstairs and will have great satisfaction in seeing you all. She does not yet leave her dressing-room. Mary and Kitty, thank heaven, are quite well, and have both sworn blood oaths against Mr. Wickham, bless their hearts. But you, how are you?" cried Elizabeth. "You look pale. How much you must have gone through." Her sister, however, assured her of being perfectly well, and their conversation, which had been passing while Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner were engaged with their children, was now put an end to by the approach of the whole party. Jane ran to her uncle and aunt and welcomed and thanked them both with alternate smiles and tears. When they were all in the drawing-room, the questions which Elizabeth had already asked were of course repeated by the others, and they soon found that Jane had no intelligence to give. She still clung to the sanguine hope that it would all end well, and that every morning would bring some letter, either from Lydia or her father, to explain their proceedings and perhaps announce their marriage. Mrs. Bennet, to whose apartment they all repaired after a few minutes' conversation together, received them exactly as might be expected, with tears and lamentations of regret, invectives against the villainous conduct of Wickham, and half a bucket's worth of vomit, blaming everybody but the person to whose ill-judging indulgence the errors of her daughter must principally be owing. "If I had been able," said she, "to carry my point in going to Brighton with all my family, this would not have happened. But poor dear Lydia had nobody to take care of her. Why did the Fosters ever let her go out of their sight? I am sure there was some great neglect or other on their side, for she is not the kind of girl to do such a thing if she had been well looked after. I always thought they were very unfit to have the charge of her, but I was overruled, as I always am, poor dear child. And now here's Mr. Bennet gone away, and I know he will fight Wickham whenever he meets him, and then he will be killed, for no matter how full his mind of Oriental trickery, his frail old body possesses none of its former grace. And then what is to become of us all? The Collinses will turn us out before he is cold in his grave, and if you are not kind to us, brother, I do not know what we shall do." They all exclaimed against such terrific ideas, and Mr. Gardiner, after general assurances of his affection for her and all her family, told her that he meant to be in London the very next day, and would assist Mr. Bennet in every endeavour for recovering Lydia. "Do not give way to useless alarm," added he, "till we know that they are not married and have no design of marrying. Do not let us give her honour over as lost. As soon as I get to town, I shall go to my brother and make him come with me to Section 6 East, and then we may consult together as to what is to be done."
"Oh, my dear brother," replied Mrs. Bennet, "that is exactly what I could most wish for. When you get to town, find them out, and if they are not married already, make them marry. And as for wedding clothes, do not let them wait for that, but tell Lydia she shall have as much money as she chooses to buy them after they are married. And above all, keep Mr. Bennet from fighting. Tell him what a dreadful state I am in, that I am frightened out of my wits, and have such trembling, such flutterings all over me, such spasms in my side and pains in my head, and such a ceaseless torrent of sick into my bucket, that I can get no rest by night nor by day."
Mr. Gardiner assured her again of his earnest endeavours in the cause, and after talking with her in this manner till dinner was on the table, they all left her to vomit in the company of the housekeeper, who attended in the absence of her daughters. Though her brother and sister were persuaded that there was no real occasion for such a seclusion from the family, they did not attempt to oppose it.
In the dining room, they were soon joined by Mary and Kitty, who had been too busily engaged in their sparring to make their appearance before. They had been busy at little else since swearing their blood oaths. Soon after they were seated at the table, Mary whispered to Elizabeth, "This is a most unfortunate affair, and will probably be much talked of. But we must stem the tide of idle chatter, and pour into our wounded bosoms the soothing balm of vengeance." Then, perceiving in Elizabeth no inclination of replying, she added, "Unhappy as the event must be for Lydia, we may draw from it this useful lesson, that virtue in a female is as easily removed as a piece of clothing, that one false step can cause endless ruin, that the only remedy for wounded honour is the blood of he who hath defiled it." Elizabeth lifted up her eyes in amazement, but was too much oppressed to make any reply. Mary, however, continued to console herself with such kind of moral extractions from the evil before them. In the afternoon, the two elder Miss Bennets were able to be for a half hour by themselves. After joining in general lamentations over the dreadful dishonouring of their sister, which Elizabeth considered as all but certain, and Jane could not assert to be wholly impossible, the former continued the subject by saying, "But tell me all and everything about it which I have not already heard. Give me further particulars. What did Colonel Foster say? Had they no apprehension of anything before the abduction took place? Colonel Foster did own that he had often suspected some particularity, especially on Lydia's side, but nothing to give him any alarm. I am so grieved for him. His behaviour was attentive and kind to the utmost. He was coming to us in order to assure us of his concern before he had any idea of Wickham's having no intention of marrying. When that apprehension first got abroad, it hastened his journey." "And was the officer convinced that Wickham would not marry? Did he know of their intending to go off?" "Yes, but when questioned by him, the officer denied knowing anything of their plans, and would not give his real opinion about it, even after the colonel threatened to feed his most English parts to the unmentionables. He did not repeat his persuasion of their not marrying, and from that I am inclined to hope he might have been misunderstood before." "And till Colonel Foster came himself, not one of you doubted that they would be hastily married? How was it possible that such an idea should enter our brains? I felt a little uneasy, a little fearful of my sister's happiness with him in marriage, because I knew that his conduct had not been always quite right. My father and mother knew nothing of that. They only felt how imprudent a match it must be. Kitty then owned, with a very natural triumph on knowing more than the rest of us, that in Lydia's last letter she had prepared her for such a step. She had known, it seems, of their being in love with each other many weeks. But not before they went to Brighton. No, I believe not. And did Colonel Foster appear to think well of Wickham himself? Does he know his real character? I must confess that he did not speak so well of Wickham as he formerly did. He believed him to be imprudent and extravagant, and since this sad affair has taken place, it is said that he left Meryton greatly in debt, and left at least one poor milkmaid in a delicate condition, but I hope this may be false. Oh, Jane, had we told what we knew of him, this could not have happened." "Perhaps it would have been better," replied her sister, "but to expose the former faults of any person without knowing what their present feelings were seemed unjustifiable. We acted with the best intentions." "Could Colonel Foster repeat the particulars of Lydia's note to his wife? He brought it with him for us to see." Jane then took it from her pocket-book and gave it to Elizabeth. These were the contents. "My dear Harriet, you will laugh when you know where I am gone, and I cannot help laughing myself at your surprise tomorrow morning as soon as I am missed. I am going to Gretna Green, and if you cannot guess with who, I shall think your brains in a zombie's teeth, for there is but one man in the world I love, and he is an angel. I should never be happy without him, so think it no harm to be off. You need not send them word at Longbourn of my going, if you do not like it, for it will make the surprise the greater when I write to them and sign my name, Lydia Wickham. What a good joke it will be! I can hardly write for laughing. I shall send for my clothes and weapons when I get to Longbourn, but I wish you would tell Sally to mend a great claw mark in my worked muslin gown before they are packed up.
Goodbye. Give my love to Colonel Foster. I hope you will drink to our good journey. Your affectionate friend, Lydia Bennet.
Oh, thoughtless, thoughtless Lydia, cried Elizabeth when she had finished it. What a letter is this to be written at such a moment? But at least it shows that she was serious on the subject of their journey. Whatever he might afterwards force her into, it was not on her side a scheme of infamy. My poor father, how he must have felt it. I never saw anyone so shocked. He could not speak a word for a full 10 minutes. My mother was taken ill immediately, and the whole house in such confusion. Oh, Jane, cried Elizabeth, you do not look well. Oh, that I had been with you. You have had every care and anxiety upon yourself alone. Mary and Kitty have been very kind, and would have shared in every fatigue, I am sure, had they not been engaged in crafting Mr. Wickham's doom. My Aunt Phillips came to Longbourn on Tuesday, after my father went away, and was so good as to stay till Thursday with me. She was of great use and comfort to us all. And Lady Lucas has been very kind. She walked here on Wednesday morning to condole with us, and offered her services, or any of her daughters, if they should be of use to us. Upon hearing Lady Lucas mentioned, Elizabeth's thoughts turned to Hunsford. She wondered if there were any of the old Charlotte left, or if Mr. Collins had yet perceived her affliction. It had, after all, been some time since she had received a letter from the parsonage. Was her friend still living? It was too frightful a subject to long dwell upon. She then proceeded to inquire into the measures which her father had intended to pursue while in town for the recovery of his daughter. "He meant, I believe," replied Jane, "to go to Epsom, the place where they last changed horses. His principal object must be to discover the number of the hackney coach which took them from Clapham after Mr. Wickham tried to kill the colonel. It had come with a fare from London, and as he thought that the circumstance of a gentleman and ladies removing from one carriage into another in a hail of musket fire might be remembered, he meant to make inquiries at Clapham. Chapter 48. The whole party were in hopes of a letter from Mr. Bennet the next morning, but the post came in without bringing a single line from him. His family knew him to be a most negligent and dilatory correspondent, but at such a time they had hoped for exertion. They were forced to conclude that he had no pleasing intelligence to send, but even of that they would have been glad to be certain. Mr. Gardiner had waited only for the letters before he set off, with 3 hired men and their guns as his companions and guarantors of expeditious passage. Mrs. Gardiner and the children were to remain in Hertfordshire a few days longer, as the former thought her presence might be serviceable to her nieces. She shared in their attendance on Mrs. Bennet, and was a great comfort to them in their hours of freedom. Their other aunt also visited them frequently, and always, as she said, with the design of cheering and heartening them up, though, as she never came without reporting some fresh instance of Wickham's leaving this bill or that bastard child, she seldom went away without leaving them more dispirited than she found them. All Meryton seemed striving to blacken the man who, but 3 months before, had been hailed as more praiseworthy than Christ himself. He was declared to be in debt to every tradesman in the place, and his intrigues, all honoured with the title of seduction, had been extended into every tradesman's family. Everybody declared that he was the wickedest young man in the world, and everybody began to find out that they had always distrusted the appearance of his goodness. Rumours of his being a zombie spy and a Frenchman flew about the countryside as if on the wings of sparrows, and at night fires could be seen from one end of Hertfordshire to the other. Such was the number of Wickham effigies being burned. Elizabeth, though she did not credit above half of what was said, believed enough to make her former assurance of her sister's ruin more certain, and even Jane, who believed still less of it, became almost hopeless, more especially as the time was now come when, if they had been married, they must in all probability have gained some news of it. Mr. Gardiner left Longbourn on Sunday. On Tuesday his wife received a letter from him. It told them that, on his arrival, he had immediately found out his brother and persuaded him to come to Section 6 East. That Mr. Bennet had been to Epsom and Clapham before his arrival, but without gaining any satisfactory information, and that he was now determined to inquire at all the principal hotels in town. There was also a postscript to this effect. I have written to Colonel Foster to desire him to find out, if possible, from some of the young man's intimates in the regiment, whether Wickham has any relations or connections who would be likely to know in what part of town he has now concealed himself. If there were anyone that one could apply to with a probability of gaining such a clue as that, it might be of essential consequence. At present, we have nothing to guide us. Colonel Foster will, I dare say, do everything in his power to satisfy us on this head. But on second thoughts, perhaps Lizzie could tell us what relations he has now living better than any person. Elizabeth had never heard of his having had any relations except a father and mother, both of whom had been dead many years. It was possible, however, that some of his companions in the militia might be able to give more information, though she was not very sanguine in expecting it. Elizabeth and Jane could find no solace in their dear wrestling, nor could they depend on their younger sisters for company, as both were forever engaged in crafting some new method of disembowelment for Mr. Wickham. Every day at Longbourn was now a day of anxiety, but the most anxious part of each was when the post was expected. The arrival of letters was the grand object of every morning's impatience. Through letters, whatever of good or bad was to be told would be communicated, and every succeeding day was expected to bring some news of importance. But before they heard again from Mr. Gardiner, a letter arrived for their father from a different quarter, from Mr. Collins, which, as Jane had received directions to open all that came for him in his absence, she accordingly read. And Elizabeth, who knew what curiosities his letters always were, looked over her and read it likewise. It was as follows.
My dear sir, I feel myself called upon by our relationship and my situation in life to condole with you on the grievous affliction you are now suffering under, and likewise inform you of my own suffering, due to a tragedy that has befallen one of your dearest acquaintances, my beloved wife, Charlotte. It is my sad duty to report that she is no more with us upon this earth. That she was somehow stricken with the strange plague, an affliction we were all blind to until Lady Catherine de Bourgh condescended to bring it to my attention in a most graceful manner. Her ladyship, I might add, was kind enough to offer her hand in carrying out the customary beheading and burning, but I felt it my husbandly duty to perform them with my own hand, trembling though it was. Be assured, my dear sir, that despite my own crippling grief, I sincerely sympathize with you and all your respectable family in your present distress, which must be of the bitterest kind. The death of your daughter would have been a blessing in comparison of this, just as the beheading and burning of my bride was a fate preferable to seeing her join the ranks of Lucifer's brigade. You are grievously to be pitied. In which opinion I am joined by Lady Catherine and her daughter, to whom I have related the affair. They agree with me in apprehending that this dishonouring of one's daughter will be injurious to the fortunes of all the others, for who, as Lady Catherine herself condescendingly says, will connect themselves with such a family? And this consideration leads me moreover to reflect with augmented satisfaction on my offer to Elizabeth last November. For had she replied otherwise, I must have been involved in your disgrace, instead of the mere sorrow which I am presently condemned to. Let me then advise you, dear sir, to throw off your unworthy child from your affection for ever, and leave her to reap the fruits of her own heinous offence. And let me conclude by congratulating you, for I shall no longer be requiring Longbourn upon your death, as I shall myself be dead by the time this post reaches you, hanging from a branch of Charlotte's favourite tree, in the garden which her ladyship was so magnanimous in granting us stewardship over. I am, dear sir, etc., etc.
Mr. Gardiner did not write again till he had received an answer from Colonel Foster, and then he had nothing of a pleasant nature to send. It was not known that Wickham had a single relationship with which he kept up any connection, and it was certain that he had no near one living. His former acquaintances had been numerous, but since he had been in the militia, it did not appear that he was on terms of particular friendship with any of them. There was no one, therefore, who could be pointed out as likely to give any news of him, and in the wretched state of his own finances there was a very powerful motive for secrecy, in addition to his fear of discovery by Lydia's relations, for it had just transpired that he had left bastards and gaming debts behind him to a very considerable amount. Colonel Forster believed that more than £1,000 would be necessary to clear his expenses at Brighton, and another £1,000 to provide for those sorry girls he had left with the stains of shame. Mr. Gardiner did not attempt to conceal these particulars from the Longbourn family. Jane heard them with horror.
"A gamester? A bastard-maker?" she cried. "This is wholly unexpected. I had not an idea of it."
Mr. Gardiner added in his letter that they might expect to see their father at home on the following day, which was Saturday. Rendered spiritless by the ill success of all their endeavours, he had yielded to his brother-in-law's entreaty that he would return to his family. When Mrs. Bennet was told of this, she did not express so much satisfaction as her children expected, considering what her anxiety for his life had been before.
"What, is he coming home? And without poor Lydia?" she cried. "Sure he will not leave London before he has found them. Who is to fight Wickham and make him marry her if he comes away?"
As Mrs. Gardiner began to wish to be at home, it was settled that she and the children should go to London, at the same time that Mr. Bennet came from it. The coach, therefore, took them the first stage of their journey and brought its master back to Longbourn. Mrs. Gardiner went away in all the perplexity about Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy that had attended her from that part of the world. His name had never been voluntarily mentioned before them by her niece, and Elizabeth had received no letters since her return that could come from Pemberley. The present unhappy state of the family rendered any other excuse for the lowness of her spirits unnecessary. Elizabeth, who was by this time tolerably well acquainted with her own feelings, was perfectly aware that had she known nothing of Darcy, she could have borne the dread of Lydia's infamy somewhat better. It would have spared her, she thought, one sleepless night out of two. When Mr. Bennet arrived, he had all the appearance of his usual philosophic composure. He said as little as he had ever been in the habit of saying, made no mention of the business that had taken him away, and it was some time before his daughters had courage to speak of it. It was not till the afternoon, when he had joined them at tea, that Elizabeth ventured to introduce the subject, and then, on her briefly expressing her sorrow for what he must have endured, he replied, "Say nothing of that. Who should suffer but myself? For every rod of wet bamboo upon the student's back, the teacher deserves two. Did not Master Lior say as much?"
"You must not be too severe upon yourself," replied Elizabeth.
"You may well warn me against such an evil. Human nature is so prone to fall into it. No, Lizzie, let me once in my life feel how much I have been to blame, for it was I who resolved that you should be warriors and not ladies. It is I who saw to your instruction in the ways of death, while neglecting to teach you anything of life. Grant me my shame, for it is most deserved."
"Do you suppose them to be in London?"
"Yes. Where else can they be so well concealed?"
"And Lydia used to want to go to London," added Kitty.
"She is happy, then," said her father dryly, "and her residence there will probably be of some duration." Then, after a short silence, he continued, "Lizzie, I bear you no ill will for being justified in your advice to me last May, which, considering the event, shows some greatness of mind." They were interrupted by Miss Bennet, who came to fetch her mother's tea. "This is a parade," he cried. "Can I not have a moment's peace in which to suffer my misfortune? Tomorrow I will sit in my library in my nightcap and robes of silk and remain there till Kitty runs away."
"I am not going to run away, Papa," said Kitty fretfully. "If I should ever go to Brighton, I would behave better than Lydia."
"You go to Brighton? I would not trust you so near it as Eastbourne for £50. No, Kitty, I have at least learnt to be cautious, and you will feel the effects of it. No officer is ever to enter into my house again, nor even to pass through the village." Balls will be absolutely prohibited unless you stand up with one of your sisters, and you are never to stir out of doors till you can prove that you have spent 10 hours of every day in pursuit of your studies. Kitty, who took all these threats in a serious light, began to cry. Well, well, said he, do not make yourself unhappy. If you are a good girl for the next 10 years, I will take you to a review at the end of them. Chapter 49 2 days after Mr. Bennet's return, as Jane and Elizabeth were tracking a buck through the shrubbery behind the house, they saw the housekeeper coming towards them, and concluding that she came to report their mother's latest fit of vomiting, went forward to meet her. But instead of the expected news, when they approached her, she said to Miss Bennet, "I beg your pardon, madam, for interrupting you, but I was in hopes you might have got some good news from town, so I took the liberty of coming to ask." "What do you mean, Hill? We have heard nothing from town." "Dear madam," cried Mrs. Hill in great astonishment, "don't you know there is an express come for Master from Mr. Gardiner? He has been here this half hour, and Master has had a letter." Away ran the girls, too eager to get in to have time for speech. When a fence crossed their path, they sprang over it, spinning through the air with the grace of throwing stars. When they reached a small stream, they leapt from bank to bank rather than diverting to the footbridge a quarter mile away. Upon reaching the house, they ran through the vestibule into the breakfast room, from thence to the library. Their father was in neither, and they were on the point of seeking him upstairs with their mother when they were met by the butler, who said, "If you are looking for my master, ma'am, he is walking towards the dojo." Upon this information, they instantly passed through the hall once more and ran across the lawn after their father, who was deliberately pursuing his way toward the modest building. Elizabeth came up with him and eagerly cried out, "Oh, Papa, what news, what news? Have you heard from my uncle?" "Yes, I have had a letter from him by express." "Well, and what news does it bring, good or bad?" "What is there of good to be expected?" said he, taking the letter from his pocket. "But perhaps you would like to read it." Elizabeth impatiently caught it from his hand. Jane now came up. "Read it aloud," said their father, "for I hardly know myself what it is about." Section 6 East, Monday, August 2nd. "My dear brother, at last I am able to send you some tidings of my niece, and such as, upon the whole, I hope it will give you satisfaction. Soon after you left me on Saturday, I was fortunate enough to find out in what part of London they were. The particulars I reserve till we meet. It is enough to know they are discovered. I have seen them both." "Then it is as I always hoped," cried Jane. "They are married." Elizabeth read on. "I have seen them both. They are not married, nor can I find there was any intention of being so. But I can happily report that Mr. Wickham has lately undergone a most remarkable change of heart on the subject, and wishes they be wed with the utmost expediency. He is in a most dreadful state, however, for a carriage accident has left him bedridden and unable to move his limbs or control his personal business. I am afraid his doctors are of the opinion that he shall remain thus for the whole course of his life, but imagine their relief to know that he shall have a devoted wife to attend to his every need till death do they part. He wishes no share of your daughter's £5,000, nor does he require more than £5 per annum to offset the cost of his linens. These are conditions which, considering everything, I had no hesitation in complying with, as far as I thought myself privileged, for you. I shall send this by express, that no time may be lost in bringing me your answer. If, as I conclude will be the case, you send me full powers to act in your name throughout the whole of this business, there will not be the smallest occasion for your coming to town again. Therefore, stay quiet at Longbourn, and depend on my diligence and care. Send back your answer as fast as you can, and be careful to write explicitly. We have judged it best that my niece should be married at Wickham's bedside, of which I hope you will approve, as there is little chance of his being moved. She comes to us today. I shall write again as soon as anything more is determined on. Yours, etc., Edward Gardiner." "Is it possible?" cried Elizabeth when she had finished. "Can it be possible that he will marry her? Wickham is not so undeserving, then, as we thought him. Oh, rendered lame by a carriage, cruel fate," said her sister. "My dear father, I congratulate you.
"'And have you answered the letter?' cried Elizabeth. "'No, but it must be done soon. "'Oh, my dear father,' she cried, "'come back and write immediately. "'Consider how important every moment is in such a case.' "'Let me write for you,' said Jane, "'if you dislike the trouble yourself.'
"'I dislike it very much,' he replied, "'but it must be done.' And so saying, he turned back with them and walked towards the house.
"'And may I ask,' said Elizabeth, "'but the terms, I suppose, must be complied with.'
"'Complied with? I am only ashamed of his asking so little.
"'Oh, wretched Lydia, to be a nurse for the rest of her days! "'And they must marry, yet he is a cripple!'
"'Yes, yes, they must marry. There is nothing else to be done. "'But there are two things that I want very much to know. "'One is how much money your uncle has laid down to bring it about, "'and the other, how am I ever to pay him?'
"'Money? My uncle?' cried Jane. "'What do you mean, sir?'
"'I mean that no man in his senses would marry Lydia on so slight a temptation as £5 a year during my life, and nothing after I am gone.'
"'That is very true,' said Elizabeth, "'though it had not occurred to me before. "'His debts to be discharged, and something still to remain. "'Oh, it must be my uncle's doings. "'Generous, good man. "'I am afraid he has distressed himself. "'A small sum could not do all this.'
"'No,' said her father. "'Wickham's a fool if he takes her with a farthing less than £10,000, "'especially since he will now have little opportunity of earning and fortune of his own. "'I should be sorry to think so ill of him in the very beginning of our relationship.'
£10,000? Heaven forbid! How is half such a sum to be repaid?'
Mr. Bennet made no answer, and each of them, deep in thought, continued silent till they reached the house. Their father then went on to the library to write, and the girls walked into the breakfast-room.
"'And they are really to be married,' cried Elizabeth, as soon as they were by themselves. "'How strange this is! And for this we are to be thankful, that they should marry, small as is their chance of happiness, and wretched as is his broken body, we are forced to rejoice. Oh, Lydia!'
"'I comfort myself with thinking,' replied Jane, "'that he certainly would not marry Lydia if he had not a real regard for her. "'Though our kind uncle has done something towards clearing him, "'I cannot believe that £10,000 or anything like it has been advanced. "'He has children of his own, and may have more. "'How could he spare half £10,000?'
"'If he were ever able to learn what Wickham's debts have been,' said Elizabeth, "'and how much is settled on his side, on our sister, "'we shall exactly know what Mr. Gardiner has done for them, "'because Wickham has not sixpence of his own. "'The kindness of my uncle and aunt can never be requited. "'Their affording her their personal protection and countenance "'is such a sacrifice to her advantage "'as years of gratitude cannot enough acknowledge. "'If such goodness does not make her miserable now, "'she will never deserve to be happy.' "'What a meeting for her when she first sees my aunt!'
"'We must endeavour to forget all that has passed on either side,' said Jane. "'I hope and trust they will yet be happy. "'His consenting to marry her is a proof, I will believe, "'that he has come to a right way of thinking. "'Their mutual affection will steady them, "'and I flatter myself they will settle so quietly, "'he in his bed and she at his side, "'as may in time make their past imprudence forgotten.'
"'Their conduct has been such,' replied Elizabeth, "'as neither you nor I nor anybody can ever forget. "'It is useless to talk of it, "'except to persuade our younger sisters "'that they must renounce their blood oath post-haste.' "'It now occurred to the girls "'that their mother was in all likelihood "'perfectly ignorant of what had happened.' They went to the library, therefore, and asked their father whether he would not wish them to make it known to her. He was writing, and without raising his head, coolly replied, "'Just as you please.
May we take my uncle's letter to read to her?
Take whatever you like and get away." Elizabeth took the letter from his writing-table, and they went upstairs together. Mary and Kitty were both with Mrs. Bennet. One communication would, therefore, do for all. After a slight preparation for good news, the letter was read aloud. Mrs. Bennet could hardly contain herself. As soon as Jane had read Mr. Gardiner's hope of Lydia's being soon married, her joy burst forth, and every following sentence added to its exuberance. She was now in an irritation as violent from delight as she ever had been fidgety from alarm and vexation. To know that her daughter would be married was enough. She was disturbed by no fear for her happiness as the eternal nurse to a lame, fortuneless husband, nor humbled by any remembrance of her misconduct.
"My dear, dear Lydia," she cried, "this is delightful indeed. She will be married. I shall see her again. She will be married at 16. My good, kind brother, I knew how it would be. I knew he would manage everything. How I long to see her, and to see dear Wickham, too. Dear crippled Wickham, what a husband he shall make. In a short time I shall have a daughter married. Mrs. Wickham, how well it sounds. And she was only 16 last June. My dear Jane, I am in such a flutter that I am sure I can't write, so I will dictate and you write for me. We will settle with your father about the money afterwards, but the things should be ordered immediately."
She was then proceeding to all the particulars of calico, muslin, and silver bedpans, and would shortly have dictated some very plentiful orders had not Jane, though with some difficulty, persuaded her to wait till her father was at leisure to be consulted. One day's delay, she observed, would be of small importance, and her mother was too happy to be quite so obstinate as usual. Other schemes, too, came into her head.
"I will go to Meryton," said she, "as soon as I am dressed, and tell the good, good news to my sister Phillips, and as I come back I can call on Lady Lucas. Her grief for dear Charlotte will be much assuaged by this joyous development. Kitty, run down and order the carriage. An airing would do me a great deal of good, I am sure. Girls, can I do anything for you in Meryton? Oh, here comes Hill. My dear Hill, have you heard the good news? Miss Lydia is going to be married, and you shall all have a bowl of punch to make merry at her wedding."
Chapter 50. Mr. Bennet had very often wished before this period of his life that instead of spending his whole income every year, he had set aside an annual sum for the better provision of his children and of his wife, if she survived him. He now wished it more than ever. Had he done his duty in that respect, Lydia need not have been indebted to her uncle for whatever of honour or credit could now be purchased for her. The satisfaction of prevailing on one of the most worthless young men in Great Britain might have been a trifle less disappointing than it now was. He was seriously concerned that a cause of so little advantage to anyone should be forwarded at the sole expense of his brother-in-law, and he was determined, if possible, to find out the extent of his assistance and to discharge the obligation as soon as he could. When first Mr. Bennet had married, economy was held to be perfectly useless, for, of course, they were to have a son. The son was to join in cutting off the entail as soon as he should be of age, and the widow and younger children would by that means be provided for. 5 daughters successively entered the world, but yet the son was to come, and Mrs. Bennet, for many years after Lydia's birth, had been certain that he would. This event had at last been despaired of, but it was then too late to be saving. Mrs. Bennet had no turn for economy, and her husband's love of independence had alone prevented their exceeding their income. £5,000 was settled by marriage articles on Mrs. Bennet and the children, but in what proportions it should be divided amongst the latter depended on the will of the parents. This was one point with regard to Lydia, at least, which was now to be settled, for Mr. Bennet felt no obligation to leave her a single sixpence. In terms of grateful acknowledgement for the kindness of his brother, though expressed most concisely, he then delivered on paper his perfect approbation of all that was done, and his willingness to fulfil the engagements that had been made for him. He had never before supposed that, could Wickham be prevailed on to marry his daughter, it would be done with so little inconvenience to himself as by the present arrangement. That it would be done with such trifling exertion on his side, too, was another very welcome surprise, for his wish at present was to have as little trouble in the business as possible. When the first transports of rage which had produced his activity in seeking her were over, he naturally returned to all his former lethargy. His letter was soon dispatched, for though dilatory in undertaking business, he was quick in its execution. He begged to know further particulars of what he was indebted to his brother, but was too angry with Lydia to send any message to her. The good news spread quickly through the house, and with proportionate speed through the neighbourhood. It was borne in the latter with decent philosophy. To be sure, it would have been more for the advantage of conversation had Miss Lydia Bennet come upon the town, or, as the happiest alternative, been secluded from the world in some distant eastern land. But there was much to be talked of in marrying her, and the good-natured wishes for her well-doing, which had proceeded before from all the spiteful old ladies in Meryton, lost but a little of their spirit in this change of circumstances, because with such a lame, indebted husband, her misery was considered certain. It was a fortnight since Mrs. Bennet had been downstairs, but on this happy day she again took her seat at the head of her table, and in spirits oppressively high. No sentiment of shame gave a damp to her triumph. The marriage of a daughter, which had been the first object of her wishes since Jane was 16, was now on the point of accomplishment, and her thoughts and her words ran wholly on those attendants of elegant nuptials, fine muslins, new muskets, and servants. She was busily searching through the neighbourhood for a proper house for her daughter, and without knowing or considering what their income might be, rejected many as deficient in size and importance. "Hay Park might do," said she, "if the Gouldings could quit it, or the great house at Stoke, if the drawing-room were larger. But Ashworth is too far off. I could not bear to have her 10 miles from me, and as for Pulvis Lodge, the attics are dreadful." Her husband allowed her to talk on without interruption while the servants remained, but when they had withdrawn, he said to her, "Mrs. Bennet, before you take any or all of these houses for your son and daughter, let us come to a right understanding. Into one house in this neighbourhood they shall never have admittance. I will not encourage the impudence of either by receiving them at Longbourn." A long dispute followed this declaration, but Mr. Bennet was firm. It soon led to another, and Mrs. Bennet found, with amazement and horror, that her husband would not advance a guinea to buy clothes for his daughter. He protested that she should receive from him no mark of affection whatever on the occasion. Mrs. Bennet could hardly comprehend it, that his anger could be carried to such a point of inconceivable resentment as to refuse his daughter a privilege without which her marriage would scarcely seem valid, exceeded all she could believe possible. She was more alive to the disgrace which her want of new clothes must reflect on her daughter's nuptials than to any sense of shame at her future son's having abducted her daughter a fortnight before they took place. Elizabeth was now most heartily sorry that she had, from the distress of the moment, been led to make Mr. Darcy acquainted with their fears for her sister, for since her marriage would so shortly give the proper termination to the elopement, they might hope to conceal its unfavourable beginning from all those who were not immediately on the spot. She had no fear of its spreading farther through his means. There were few people on whose secrecy she would have more confidently depended. But at the same time, there was no one whose knowledge of a sister's frailty would have mortified her so much, not, however, from any fear of disadvantage to herself, for she expected there would be no more civilities between them. Had Lydia's marriage been concluded on the most honourable terms, it was not to be supposed that Mr. Darcy would connect himself with a family where, to every other objection, would now be added an alliance with a man whom he so justly scorned. What a triumph for him, she often thought. Could he know that the proposals which she had proudly spurned only 4 months ago would now have been most gladly and gratefully received? He was as generous, she doubted not, as the most generous of his sex, but while he was mortal, there must be a triumph. She began now to comprehend that he was exactly the man who, in disposition and talents, would most suit her. His understanding and temper, though unlike her own, would have answered all her wishes. It was an union that must have been to the advantage of both. By her aggression and liveliness, his introversion might have been softened, his manners improved, and from his judgment, information, and knowledge of the world, she must have received benefit of greater importance. What a pair of warriors they would make! Sparring by the river at Pemberley, crossing the Altai Mountains in a fine coach on their way to Kyoto or Shanghai, their children eager to master death as their mother and father had before them. But no such happy marriage could now teach the admiring multitude what connubial felicity really was. an union of a different tendency, and precluding the possibility of the other, was soon to be formed in their family. How Wickham and Lydia were to be supported in tolerable independence she could not imagine, but how little of permanent happiness could belong to a couple who were only brought together by an abduction, an attempted murder, and a carriage accident, she could easily conjecture. Mr. Gardiner soon wrote again to his brother. The principal purport of his letter was to inform them that Mr. Wickham had resolved on quitting the militia. "It was greatly my wish that he should do so as soon as his marriage was fixed on, and I think you will agree with me in considering that he can do little good in the fight against the zombies, given his present condition. It is Mr. Wickham's intention to enter the priesthood, and among his former friends there are still some who are able and willing to assist him in this endeavour. He has the promise of joining a special seminary for the lame in northernmost Ireland. It is an advantage to have it so far from this part of the kingdom. He promises fairly, and I hope among different people, where they may each have a character to preserve, they will both be more prudent. I have written to Colonel Foster to inform him of our present arrangements, and to request that he will satisfy the various creditors of Mr. Wickham in and near Brighton with assurances of speedy payment, for which I have pledged myself. And will you give yourself the trouble of carrying similar assurances to his creditors in Meryton, of whom I shall subjoin a list according to his information? He has given in all his debts. I hope at least he has not deceived us. I understand from Mrs. Gardiner that my niece is very desirous of seeing you all before she leaves for Ireland. She is well, and begs to be dutifully remembered to you and your mother. Yours, etc., E. Gardiner. Mr. Bennet and his daughters saw all the advantages of Wickham's removal from England as clearly as Mr. Gardiner could do. But Mrs. Bennet was not so well pleased with it. Lydia's being settled in the north, just when she had expected most pleasure and pride in her company, was a severe disappointment. And besides, it was such a pity that Lydia should be taken from a regiment where she was acquainted with everybody, and could instruct soldiers in new methods of annihilating the walking dead. "She is so fond of Mrs. Foster," said she. "It will be quite shocking to send her away. And there are several of the young men, too, that she likes very much." His daughter's request, for such it might be considered, of being admitted into her family again before she set off for the north, received at first an absolute negative. But Jane and Elizabeth, who agreed in wishing, for the sake of their sister's feelings and consequence, that she should be noticed on her marriage by her parents, urged him so earnestly, yet so rationally, and so mildly, to receive her and her husband at Longbourn as soon as they were married, that he was prevailed on to think as they thought, and act as they wished. And their mother had the satisfaction of knowing that she would be able to show her married daughter in the neighbourhood before she was banished to St. Lazarus Seminary for the lame at Kilkenny. When Mr. Bennet wrote again to his brother, therefore, he sent his permission for them to come, and it was settled that as soon as the ceremony was over, they should proceed to Longbourn. Elizabeth was surprised, however, that Wickham should consent to such a scheme, considering what a dreadful visage he must present in his sorry condition. Chapter 51 Their sister's wedding day arrived, and Jane and Elizabeth felt for her probably more than Lydia felt for herself. The carriage was sent to meet them, and they were to return in it by dinner-time. Their arrival was dreaded by the elder Miss Bennets, and Jane more especially, who imagined the feelings which would have attended herself had she been forced to marry her crippled abductor, and was wretched in the thought of what her sister must endure for the rest of her miserable life. They came. The family were assembled in the breakfast-room to receive them. Smiles decked the face of Mrs. Bennet as the carriage drove up to the door. Her husband looked impenetrably grave, her daughters alarmed, anxious, uneasy. Lydia's voice was heard in the vestibule, the door was thrown open, and she ran into the room. Her mother stepped forwards, embraced her, and welcomed her with rapture, gave her hand with an affectionate smile to Wickham, who was carried through the door by servants. Leather straps kept him fastened to his travelling bed, which was redolent of stale piss. And Elizabeth, who had been expecting as much, was nevertheless shocked at the severity of his injuries. His face remained bruised, his eyes half closed with swelling. His legs were broken and bent beyond hope, and his speech much affected.
"Dear sweet Wickham," cried Mrs. Bennet, "what a fine priest you shall make! What a delightful husband!"
Wickham replied with a polite moan.
Their reception from Mr. Bennet, to whom they then turned, was not quite so cordial. His countenance rather gained in austerity, and he scarcely opened his lips. The stench of Wickham's bed, indeed, was enough to provoke him. Elizabeth was disgusted, and even Miss Bennet was shocked. Lydia was Lydia still, untamed, unabashed, wild, noisy, and fearless. She turned from sister to sister, demanding their congratulations, and when at length they all sat down, save Wickham, who was placed by the fire, looked eagerly round the room, took notice of some little alteration in it, and observed with a laugh that it was a great while since she had been there. There was no want of discourse. The bride and her mother could neither of them talk fast enough. They seemed each of them to have the happiest memories in the world. Nothing of the past was recollected with pain, and Lydia led voluntarily to subjects which her sisters would not have alluded to for the world.
"Only think of its being 3 months," she cried, "since I went away. It seems but a fortnight, I declare, and yet there have been things enough happened in the time. Good gracious! When I went away, I am sure I had no more idea of being married till I came back again, though I thought it would be very good fun if I was."
Her father lifted up his eyes. Jane was distressed. Elizabeth looked expressively at Lydia. But she, who never heard nor saw anything of which she chose to be insensible, gaily continued,
"Oh, Mamma, do the people hereabouts know I am married today? I was afraid they might not. And we passed William Goulding, whose curricle had been overturned and horses devoured, so I was determined he should know it, and so I let down the side glass next to him and took off my glove and let my hand just rest upon the window frame so that he might see the ring, and then I bowed and smiled like anything. He yelled after us, something about his son being trapped. But, oh, Mamma, I am sure he saw the ring. Oh, think of how the news will spread!"
Elizabeth could bear it no longer. She got up and ran out of the room and returned no more till she heard them passing through the hall to the dining parlour. She then joined them soon enough to see Lydia, with anxious parade, walk up to her mother's right hand and hear her say to her eldest sister,
"Ah, Jane, I take your place now, and you must go lower, because I am a married woman."
It was not to be supposed that time or the odour of stale piss would give Lydia that embarrassment from which she had been so wholly free at first. Her ease and good spirits increased. She longed to see Mrs. Phillips, the Lucases, and all their other neighbours, and to hear herself called Mrs. Wickham by each of them. And in the meantime she went after dinner to show her ring and boast of being married to Mrs. Hill and the 2 housemaids.
"Well, Mamma," said she, when they were all returned to the breakfast-room, "and what do you think of my husband? Is not he a charming man? I am sure my sisters must all envy me. I only hope they may have half my good luck. They must all go to Brighton. That is the place to get husbands." "What a pity it is, Mamma, we did not all go." "Very true, and if I had my will, we should. But, my dear Lydia, I don't at all like your going such a way off. Must it be so?" "Oh, Lord, yes, there is nothing in that. I shall like it of all things. You and Papa and my sisters must come to the seminary and see us. We shall be at Kilkenny these next 3 years, and I will take care to get good husbands for them all." "I should like it beyond anything," said her mother. "Oh, so many young priests, and each of them in dire need of a loving, caring wife. I dare say I shall see each of my sisters married before winter."
"I thank you for my share of the favour," said Elizabeth, "but I do not particularly desire the rest of my life spent emptying piss-pots." Their visitors were not to remain above 10 days with them. Mr. Wickham had received his letter of acceptance to Kilkenny, and given his condition, the journey north would be frightfully slow. No one but Mrs. Bennet regretted that their stay would be so short, and she made the most of the time by visiting about with her daughter and having very frequent parties at home so that their neighbours might congratulate Mr. Wickham, who remained by the fire during the whole of their stay. Lydia was exceedingly fond of him. He was her dear Wickham on every occasion. He did everything best in the world, and she was sure he would kill more zombies this season than anybody else in the country, in spite of the fact that he had no use of his arms. One morning, soon after their arrival, as she was sitting with her two elder sisters, she said to Elizabeth,
"Lizzie, I never gave you an account of my wedding. Are you not curious to hear how it was managed?"
"No, really," replied Elizabeth. "I think there cannot be too little said on the subject."
"La, you are so strange, but I must tell you how it went off. We were married, you know, at St. Clement's, because it had the fewest steps to carry my beloved up, and it was settled that we should all be there by 11 o'clock. My uncle and aunt and I were to go together, and the others were to meet us at the church. Well, Monday morning came, and I was in such a fuss. I was so afraid, you know, that something would happen to put it off, for there had lately been some trouble on the east wall, and everywhere one heard talk of relinquishing the neighbourhood for safety. And there was my aunt, all the time I was dressing, preaching and talking away, just as if she was reading a sermon. However, I did not hear above one word in 10, for I was thinking, you may suppose, of my dear Wickham. I longed to know whether he would be married in his blue coat, or if he had soiled it like the others. Well, and so we breakfasted at 10, as usual. I thought it would never be over, for, by the by, you are to understand that my uncle and aunt were horrid unpleasant all the time I was with them. If you'll believe me, I did not once put my foot out of doors, though I was there a fortnight. Not one party or scheme or anything. To be sure, London was rather thin because of the attacks, but, however, the little theatre was open. Well, and so just as the carriage came to the door, my uncle was called away upon business to that horrid powder factory. Well, I was so frightened I did not know what to do, for my uncle was to give me away, and if we were beyond the hour, we could not be married all day. But luckily he came back again in 10 minutes' time, and then we all set out. However, I recollected afterwards that if he had been prevented going, the wedding need not be put off, for Mr. Darcy might have done as well."
"Mr. Darcy?" repeated Elizabeth in utter amazement.
"Oh, yes, he was to come there with Wickham, you know. But, gracious me, I quite forgot. I ought not to have said a word about it. I promised them so faithfully. What will Wickham say? It was to be such a secret."
"If it was to be secret," said Jane, "say not another word on the subject. You may depend upon my seeking no further." "Oh, certainly," said Elizabeth, though burning with curiosity. "We will ask you no questions."
"Thank you," said Lydia, "for if you did, I should certainly tell you all, and then Wickham would surely punish me with an ill-timed soiling."
On such encouragement to ask, Elizabeth was forced to put it out of her power by running away. But to live in ignorance on such a point was impossible, or at least it was impossible not to try for information. Mr. Darcy had been at her sister's wedding. What possible motive could he have had? Conjectures, rapid and wild, hurried into her brain, but she was satisfied with none. Those that best pleased her, as placing his conduct in the noblest light, seemed most improbable. She could not bear such suspense, and hastily seizing a sheet of paper, wrote a short letter to her aunt to request an explanation of what Lydia had dropped. "You may readily comprehend," she added, "what my curiosity must be to know how a person unconnected with any of us, and, comparatively speaking, a stranger to our family, should have been amongst you at such a time. Pray write instantly, and let me understand it, unless it is, for very cogent reasons, to remain in the secrecy which Lydia seems to think necessary, and then I must endeavour to be satisfied with ignorance." "And, my dear aunt," she added to herself as she finished the letter, "if you do not tell me in an honourable manner, I shall certainly be reduced to tricks and stratagems to find it out."
Chapter 52.
Elizabeth had the satisfaction of receiving an answer to her letter as soon as she possibly could. She was no sooner in possession of it than, hurrying into the dojo, where she was least likely to be interrupted, she sat down and prepared to be happy, for the length of the letter convinced her that it did not contain a denial.
Section 6 East, September 6th. My dear niece, I have just received your letter, and shall devote this whole morning to answering it, as I foresee that a little writing will not comprise what I have to tell you.
On the very day of my coming home from Longbourn, your uncle had a most unexpected visitor. Mr. Darcy called and was shut up with him several hours. It was all over before I arrived, so my curiosity was not so dreadfully racked as yours seems to have been. He came to tell Mr. Gardiner that he had found out where your sister and Mr. Wickham were. From what I can collect, he left Derbyshire only one day after ourselves and came to town with the resolution of hunting for them. Mr. Darcy felt himself to blame for